Welcome back to Decades on Dirt Roads. This is Catherine.
And this is Maddie. Today we got to interview Vic Coggins. He's a former wildlife biologist in northeastern Oregon. And yeah, he is formerly known as the zookeeper, just with all of the species that he got to work with in northeastern Oregon, like pretty cream of the crop in terms of biologist areas. He got to work with just about every species. Super cool guy. Got to sit in his shop where he has all of his taxidermy, all of his old journals. I think that was one of the cooler things for me. I mean, like,
yeah,
obviously
the same thing as Ted, like just taking that record of everything you did for the last 50 years of your career.
Yeah. I mean, dozens of journals, mm-hmm. handwritten dialogues of every single day, yeah. What he did and then how all that got used. Obviously,
his book.
Yeah, through his book, and then for policies and for data recording for all the animals being reintroduced to northeastern Oregon.
Yeah, and so the book that he wrote with his wife is called "Memories of a Backcountry Bio: 50 Years Managing Wallowa County Wildlife," and we'll link that book in the show notes and in the Instagram and Facebook post. So if you are interested in reading his book after hearing this podcast, you can find that. So we hope you enjoy.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us today, Vic. We'll go ahead and kind of start the podcast with, giving us an introduction of who you are, where we are, and what you did for a career.
Okay. And just nudge me if I forget something.
Yes. So. Okay. All right.
Anyway, I guess I should go back to where I was raised in the Rogue Valley.
Yeah.
And was always interested in wildlife from the time I was a small boy. In fact, there's some pictures in the book here of some of the many animals that I had. And I worked for a veterinarian down there when I was about 5 years part-time, and did horseshoeing as well, and went from the time I was about 16 to it got so populated down there I wanted to leave, and so I'd been up here, been up the Minum hunting, and so this was a goal to try to get here. So anyway, I graduated from OSU in 1967, and I had worked up here a couple of summers. And since I knew about horses, one of my assignments was doing high lake surveys, which was pretty interesting.
Oh, cool.
You gill netted and sounded the lakes by hand.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a month or so I spent up there in a camp. In those days, our office was in the fish hatchery, Wallowa Hatchery, so everybody did a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
From loading fish in the morning for them to take out to haze an elk and stream counts and
do all guys.
Yeah, but most of it was very field oriented.
Gotcha.
So I ended up spending a lot of time out, and always did, even later.
So then you grew up in the Rogue Valley area, and then did you have like a family farm or anything that you?
We had a small place and horses there.
Okay. And so you kind of always knew you were going to do something outdoors.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. And then you went to OSU.
I went to OSU.
And you got a degree in biology.
And wildlife management.
Okay, but you had come to northeastern Oregon and hunted, so that's where you got.
That's where I learned about Wallowa County.
Okay.
And the Minum.
That's where you got the taste of the magic.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
It's cool. Funny because Penninger also worked as a vet tech.
I didn't know he worked as a vet.
Yeah, he was going to go into veterinary science.
Well,
so it's kind
I
of a funny,
about it too.
Very funny parallel with like wildlife biologists. Like you're like, well, should I do this? Should I go here?
Yeah.
And then you end up.
Of course, we had the veterinarian I worked for was a really good family friend too, and so we had a lot of adventures there.
I bet. But that would have been a pretty natural path for you. But you found Wallowa County.
Well, and it was a good background because, we didn't do a lot of drugging animals was fairly new, and I was pretty comfortable doing it with some of the drugs that weren't real safe for them.
Yeah.
Or people.
Yeah. You learn as you go.
No.
Is that back when they were doing, like, giving cats, like, LSD or something like something? What did Ted
the,
say?
The ones that were the worst. It wasn't LSD. Let's see. I had Cernulin was what we used a lot on bears and stuff.
Poof.
And then one day I got an order, get rid of that. It's restricted.
Uh-oh. There's some red tape around this now.
So I dumped it out. And
as one would.
All right. But then some of the later ones were really, you really had to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were safe for animals, pretty safe for like elk, deer and elk, but not for humans.
Gotcha.
So
yeah, gotta be careful. Tread lightly with that one. Right. Might not have Vic around anymore.
Right. Yeah. No. I mean, I remember using it. We didn't know it.
Yeah. You don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
So then, okay, you got to the fish hatchery, and then how did you become a biologist?
Well, I had to get a degree.
Okay.
So I kept going to school, you know, and wintertime till I finally graduated in April 1967 and came here permanently then.
Been here ever since.
I've been here ever since.
Okay.
I had one short time. I thought about going for a master's, and so I was in Pendleton working on pheasants, which turned out to be extremely boring. Not that the pheasant, but you could only see them in the morning early.
Fair, yeah.
Then you had all day. So, and by then I was used to running wild, so.
Yeah, that's fair.
So, it's hard for me to, and I was tired of school, so.
So then with that, did you, I mean, obviously Eastern Oregon, I mean, you've worked with just about every species, and this is the cream of the crop. This is the magic land for all the cool animals that are here.
And I like mountain goats get kind of passed by sometimes, but you know, there was a point in time we only had about 20 mountain goats in Oregon.
Yeah, so at what point in your career did, I guess from the beginning, you know, was there a certain animal that you found a lot of interest in, or?
Obviously bighorns.
Yeah.
Which proved to be a real challenge.
Yeah.
And goats were too, and not so much. See, they were never thought to have been native in Oregon. They thought the Columbia was a barrier, which is nonsense, but I went through, and Pat Matthews, my assistant, and some of the other guys did an extensive review of some of the old literature, and they turned up some really, I mean, they were obviously all the way down the Cascades, and I've since found some pictures of pictographs of mountain goats and Klamath.
Dang.
And they were at They went on into Northern California too, although I'm not sure California recognizes that. But anyway, once we got that established, before that we had trouble getting any approval for any sites other than where we had mountain goats.
Mm-hmm. Which was where?
Just right to Hurricane Creek and
gotcha.
And the Lostine River and a few in the Lower River.
Gotcha.
But now we probably have about 1,000 anyway, goats with those in the Cascades.
So you had to provide this huge burden of proof to be able to do anything.
Yeah, and I started going through archaeological digs, you know, the results of them. I had some friends that were Forest Service archaeologists, and they were always on the lookout for me. And one of the ladies that was one of the foremost historians, she's gone now, but she was always on the lookout for me too, and so that's how we turned some of them.
That is such a huge undertaking.
Oh, it was a huge undertaking. Then you try to change people's opinion that came along thinking, no, they weren't native.
Yeah.
So, but then we had them, got them in the Elkhorns, and that was kind of the key because they did really well there. And we started trapping and transplanting. And when you trap in-state and release in-state, it's much simpler. We didn't have a budget, so all we did is a bunch of us got together and used drop nets on salt and and just started transplanting goats.
Yeah, make it happen.
Yeah.
Dang, so yeah, talk about that process. So you take all that undertaking of saying, hey, no, these animals, I mean, they're native to here, they belong here.
Yeah.
It was
a process. The other thing that's pretty good information is the Indian languages. Do they have a word for goats? Every one of them did.
Mm.
So, all different.
Yeah.
But every one of them did. And so, then finally they got involved in some. I worked with the Nez Perce tribe and then later the Umatilla tribe a huge amount, especially on bighorns. Because they were instrumental in getting rid of domestic sheep in a lot of the national forest. And where the states couldn't do much because of the politics, but the tribes could.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but anyway, I spent a lot of time with that, you know, working on elk. And at times that was pretty controversial because we were building numbers up.
Yeah.
So we had what we called the elk wars. But then we got that pretty well settled, and the livestock pretty much went out of Hell's Canyon after the Hell's Canyon National Recreation Area formed, and so that wasn't an issue any longer.
So what were the two sides of the elk wars?
The livestock side was, they had seen this big increase in elk, and it was just a 4-H competition thing. But then when those weren't even allotments anymore, well, there was no real argument.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And then the wolves came, and that all the other stuff pretty well went away. So, but and then the mule deer has been the one they have really dropped off in numbers. I'd say a lot of the, especially the wilderness areas.
Yeah.
Because I think predation is a big factor, because we didn't have, that was the thing when the sheep were in Hell's Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
It was just intensive predator control. They had to do that or they to keep them alive and have something to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably were somewhat competitive with the mule deer, but they got so much protection out of it that they just did excellent. And there was a huge population in Hell's Canyon and in the Wawas too.
Mm-hmm.
But Hell's Canyon especially.
For mule deer.
Mm. But now it's probably 10%.
Yeah.
In both of them, if it's that.
Absolutely.
Elk fared a little better, but they still are really hit by predation.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that's cougar predation on, and now wolves, but so we don't know how that's going to shake out, because usually cougar numbers drop when wolf numbers increase, so they end up being pretty good competitors. The cougar kills something, and of course they can climb a tree and get away.
Yeah.
But they can't take their, they don't take their kill up there with them.
Yeah, right.
So the wolf comes along the pack and eats.
Yeah, eats, takes care of the entree.
Yeah. And then they have to go kill something else. And if you have enough wolves, it's pretty hard for them to make it. So.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see how that shakes out. But that could make a huge difference if the wolves don't just take their place and mm-hmm. kill them. But
dang, you talk about a lot of, I mean, we could sit here and talk about each one of those controversial things, but as a biologist, like, you talk about, you know, the reintroduction of goats around here, your work with the sheep, the elk, and then predators. What was, like, in your career when you were writing your book, like, what was the most controversial or most, like, notable thing?
Wolves were the most controversial. And so a lot of it was the way they were managed.
Gotcha.
That if there was a kill, it was always in favor of the wolf. And so it's better now, but there's still a lot of animosity.
Yeah.
And I my opinion, and I was involved in some, but our hands were pretty well tied as what we could do.
I was going to say, how did an everyday biologist life, how did that directly affect you? What did you have to do?
They'd call. At first, we had a wolf coordinator. I don't know if you knew Russ Morgan or not.
I think I've heard the name.
Yeah. Anyway, they'd call him at first, but then later we started having so many that they'd call me too, and I'd end up having to go out on wolf depredations, and that just, anywhere there's any number of wolves, that just takes field bios time, so much time.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's because we demand too much proof. Instead of treating them like any other wildlife.
As, like, the agency as a whole?
Yeah, and that comes from the governor's office, a lot of it.
Yeah.
So I'm not blaming
the
director anything, but...
It's just the reality.
It was a reality on the ground.
Dang.
And then they had a real backward way. Instead of the people that did the investigation making the call, whether it was a wolf kill or not, you had to write an elaborate report. You had to have all kinds of pictures, which wasted a bunch of time.
That you had to go do as a biologist.
And you had to do that, too. And so that made the... You know, you'd have one that just was so obvious. I mean, a lot of us have seen a lot of kills over the years.
Right.
Hundreds of them.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't hard to figure it out.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes they ate the evidence, and it was, but lots of times it was just so clear that, and that was the frustration with the stockmen.
Mm.
So, to me, most of them were pretty darn patient.
Yeah.
So, but that was the most controversial. And then some of the old wilderness. I was involved with some creating some of the wildernesses, providing a lot of the wildlife information and stuff. So,
And what was that?
The Wenaha was the one that was really controversial, and the department favored the Wenaha becoming a wilderness.
Gotcha.
So that was the involvement there, and some of the others too, Hell's Canyon National Recreation Area.
Gotcha.
We were involved with all of the write-ups on the different the way it's set up. It's got different management for different sections, and it's actually worked pretty darn good, I think, overall.
That's good.
So,
but you were a part of that justification of putting that literature together and time on the ground.
That's a lot of the wildlife values is where I'd come in.
Gotcha.
And of course, the Wenaha was just a wonderful place. Have you been?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty unique.
Oh, yeah.
That it's got a river that starts in the wilderness and ends, you know, it doesn't quite go all the way in the wilderness, but most of it.
Mm-hmm.
So
what years were those incorporated roughly?
Let's see, I think the Wenaha was in the 70s or early 80s. It was in the early 80s because it was about the last one other than some additions.
Mm-hmm.
Lower Minum was another one. See, it was the forest, they wanted to build a road up the Minum and log it, see.
Oh, wow.
And so we opposed that because of the elk.
Yeah.
And now bighorns too and goats. So. Mm-hmm. But that old wilderness boundary was clear up in North Minum Meadows.
Dang.
So...
That's just a lot of stuff thrown in a career. And I mean, you're not even into the 90s yet of your storytelling. Like, this is...
No, this was all pretty much pre-90s.
But... That's jam-packed.
So were you involved at all with, like, the Rocky Mountain...
Elk Foundation?
Yeah, with what they just bought.
I was on more on the fund, helping raise some of the funds.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
We got... I think it was around 100,000 from Oregon Hunters, and I was on the board part of the time, and then I'm on their advisory board now, and so we put the arm on a lot of the chapters, and a lot of the chapters had come up with what, you know, they could afford, but it was, and then the Oregon wild sheep as well. Mm. They put up 50,000.
Wow.
So, which is quite a bit for small groups.
Yeah.
So, and the Elk Foundation got a lot of that was a grant too, fortunately. But
gotcha.
I was involved in a whole bunch of the early attempts to buy that.
And I mean, yeah, it's been for sale since the 90s, maybe earlier.
Well, yeah, but the prices, see, were so high you couldn't get an appraisal. We just couldn't come up with it. So, but this last time, I kept thinking something was going to happen, but it didn't. It actually started, the attempt to purchase that was started in the 50s, way before my time.
Whoa. So back in the Boise days then?
Well, when even Boise before cast? The Boise, when we had it all worked out.
Was it Mount Emily Lumber before?
No, it was different landowners. Oh. Anderson Ranch was, and a lot smaller pieces. Mm-hmm. Boise brought it,
consolidated it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then just before they sold out, we had it going pretty good, and I think we would have got it, but then they sold it, and there it went down the tube. So I was so relieved when we ended up, and especially we ended up with all of it. So it's so important to mule deer, now whitetails, and all kinds of other wildlife, elk, and eventually bighorns, early settlers. Told stories of killing wagon loads of bighorns out on those flats.
Yeah. That's wild.
So it's just extremely important besides public access.
Mm-hmm.
So as I was involved in a lot of, and when Tim got the ranch,
yeah,
there was all those other parcels.
Yeah.
We had a group here that got the Nature Conservancy to purchase it.
Oh.
And after we had a deal going where there was going to be a land exchange, and then that fell through about three times. We did get it going again, and then it fell through again. But it finally ended up, then the forest ended up buying those scattered parcels, which a lot of them were like major access points, and some of those flats along the Mohawk River that are now public. Mm-hmm. So.
Dang. So with your, kind of going back to your stuff with the Wenaha, I mean, that has to be pretty fun as a biologist, like putting all that stuff together to, like.
It was, but boy, a lot of times, it just took forever because they had to go through Congress and you had to convince.
Yeah, I guess that's fair.
You had our representatives, and senators.
Yeah.
Which we were able to do in Washington and Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
So.
It was probably the same for like all these agreements that you're talking about right now, where it was on the table, it was off the table, because you probably had to readjust and go find out more stuff.
Yeah, and then the appraisal wouldn't come out and match. Mm. So, because of course the seller always wanted more.
Yeah.
Anyway, that one, John, John Poston?
Mm-mm.
He's the bio in the Grand, well, for the region. But anyway, he was just instrumental in the Bynum purchase. So, I mean, so a lot of other people were too.
Yeah.
Any of these things, I have a lot of involvement in other people.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a big group effort.
It is.
Yeah, I went to they had like a big celebration for the Bynum, and they did that tour up there.
Right.
Were you there?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, because I was going to say John's name got brought up a lot.
Yeah.
And he was very greatly rewarded for his time in that.
Yeah. Yeah, he's recovering right now from a nasty mule wreck in elk season, so.
Oh, no.
Oh, gosh.
He's still, they had to put a plate in his back. And so,
what happened?
Well, they were kind of coming out of the Bynum, and they were almost to the trailhead, and a deer jumped out in front of his mule, which set his mule off, and he ended up getting thrown into a tree.
Oh,
God.
And it just broke him up bad.
Yeah.
And fortunately, they were back to the road, even though it snowed in, and so they could chain a rig up and get him and transfer him to Boise.
Ooh.
So
that's nasty.
Yeah, and that, but he's really set for him. Set it's hard, yeah. And he's got to just stay pretty motionless, you know, until that gets a chance to heal.
Yeah, rest up
that, with all that metal in him.
Yeah, rest up for next elk season.
Yeah, yeah. I hope he can ride.
Yeah,
that's be the big thing. But,
okay, so you've got this. You've got your book in front of you. Yeah. Talk about what it was like writing that.
Well, it was a lot of effort. It took 5 years for me and Vicky typed all of it. And
wow.
Then we had. He said he wasn't an editor, but he was really, and he did all the work on the pictures and stuff.
Wow.
So.
And you kept, like you talked about before we got on the air, you wrote in your journal every day of what you did,
yeah,
on the job.
Yeah, so I'd have an entry every day.
Every day.
Yeah, I didn't always do it right that same day, but I did most of the time.
That's impressive.
Because it was easier, but.
Yeah.
But then I also had, we'd stay at different ranches sometimes, like the summit that I got a chapter in here on Mille Lacs and Joe Onandia that had the Cherry Creek Sheep Ranch.
Oh, cool.
And we would stay right in there in the wintertime and stay with them. And it was very isolated. It was like taking a step back in time because the herders were there and they had two or three bands of sheep depending on the year.
That's cool.
So
that reminds me of when the Aikensons are talking about living in the Frank Church. It was a time portal, time warp. If you just go back,
that's what it was.
Yeah.
It was, well, all a lot of Hell's Canyon was. Is yeah. I spent a lot of time horseback, in Upper Hell's Canyon and on those some were cattle, but most were sheep, and so I knew all the herders.
Yeah.
So. Well, all you had to do was go to the range rider when they were off. But anyway, there was a lot of information in the Bascos, as we called them.
Mm.
They were. I've got a lot of stuff that they told me. Mm-hmm. Gus had been there since 1917, so he was.
He's a good old boy.
you had the language.
Yeah.
Which was a little hard to understand because sometimes they'd forget we didn't necessarily speak Basque.
Yeah.
And they talked pretty fast.
Yeah.
But it was really quite an experience. And at the time, I just thought it was normal.
Yeah, everyday life.
Yeah,
it was. Just going to work.
Yeah. So, yeah, but we'd use the goat lower and on, then pack in there the next day with the horses. And we did deer surveys by horseback then.
Shoo.
So. Deer and elk, it was, and we had all those routes in our country being rugged, you know, and roadless.
Yep.
You did a lot of horseback, Lower Minum, the same way. I mean, I rode all that every winter. We used to go in January up to Red's Horse Ranch, and we had a cabin above their Millard Guard Station that we stayed at. So that was quite an experience.
I bet.
So
you mentioned you wrote the book with your wife kind of helping. How did she play into this? Because it's not just a career. It's a lifestyle. Legible. Yeah.
And then she, of course, was home when I was gone.
Yeah.
We had three kids, so I missed a lot.
Yeah.
But because I probably, in the summertime, and I was probably gone at least a week, a month, on a horse trek or boat.
Somewhere.
I did a lot on the Snake River with boats too, jet boats. And
wow.
Worked with the state police all the time. We did a lot of law enforcement in those days, so during all the hunting seasons.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd be out at, stay at Thomas and Meadows for weeks on end. and patrolling. Because we had all those road closures, which we started up here.
Yeah.
And they take a lot of effort to do them right.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to be out there.
Yeah. So, she's holding down the fort.
Yeah.
With three kids.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
She did.
Dang.
But as far as she would edit,
mm-hmm.
edit, and she could read my writing most of the time.
Nice.
She always complained I wrote too small. But no, I went through a bunch of the sheep die-offs and was involved in some court cases with the tribe.
Yeah, because your journals were probably, isn't that something that you can use in those cases?
Yeah, no, I went through the Lostine disease episode. There were some others before, but, you know, we just find dead sheep and didn't really know, but I was right with them treating. I had several vets, and especially one of the local ones that would go up there with me and had me lined out on what to give them.
Dang.
So, but we still lost 2/3 of them. And we started learning then that, you know, that you better keep them away from domestic goats.
Yeah.
And domestic sheep. So, and then we worked with WSU, the vet school, for years.
Yeah.
You know, Bill Ferret was one of the profs there that would come up and took an interest, always brought some students with him. And
that's super cool.
And so we had a real close relationship with them. And then we worked with Idaho and Washington because we shared a lot of those herds and actually went to Canada together, to Alberta, and got sheep, expeditions.
Picked out your winners and said, you're coming to Eastern Oregon.
Yeah, yeah. We had a coal mine. I had some buddies that were bios up there. And so you almost have to know somebody.
Oh, I'm sure. It's like anything. It's not what you know, it's who you know.
Yeah. They had a coal mine, a strip coal mine, active. And those sheep came into that coal mine because they did a lot of reclamation work. So they changed a forest into sheep habitat. And then they seeded it.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, they had 500, 600 sheep there at one point.
Wait, this is in Canada?
Yeah, this is in Alberta.
Wow.
Central Alberta. So I think I went up there 4 times for sheep. And
that had to be pretty cool.
Yeah. And so you always wondered what was going to happen. We'd go in February. And so, because you had to do it, they were migratory, and they'd go up in the park, in the summertime. But that was pretty interesting, seeing them around those great big earth movers. They paid no attention to the people.
Really?
No, but since they closed that close, they ran out of coal in that spot, and so they closed that mine, and their sheep herd just plummeted.
Wow.
The predators moved in, see?
Mm-hmm.
And they just took them way down. So that source isn't available, but they were huge sheep, being northern Rocky sheep. Actually, the Lostine herd came from Jasper Park.
Really?
Yeah. And so in 1971, that was the first sheep came to Hell's Canyon Dam, and which was a bad site because there were lots of domestics there, and so they didn't last.
Yeah, because where did you guys put the sheep in?
Oh boy, we put them. It's all in here. There's a table that's got all of the sheep transplants, where they're from, where they went.
Oh, gotcha.
In here, which I had good records through my journals, and I was involved in most of them, so I could. And I could piece together the rest of it. So I just thought we should have accurate records. The same is true with mountain goats. All of where every goat transplanted, and the recent ones are in there. So, but those were adventures.
Yeah.
And
care to share some adventures?
Getting through the border was always a big hassle. Yeah, to have all those health certificates and I can't remember now the one that there was one that you had to take the blood and have the test done at the border, so you'd have to pull the blood as we caught them.
Whoa.
And then take it to a lab and try to get the results while we were headed for the transplant site down here.
What's that time frame? Like what?
Well, you don't have much time.
No, no, I know. But like what? Like take us through that. Like you know, you kill it. Well, not kill it, but you capture it on a Tuesday. You take the blood, and then when are they?
That somebody takes that blood just immediately and heads for that lab. One time we'd worked it out to have the governors of Oregon's airplane up there, and some friends of mine were the pilots. See that. They didn't normally fly her air or his airplane.
Right.
Then, then let's see. There was some. I remember we were sitting in there having a beer in the lodge there, getting ready for the transplant the next day.
Uh-huh.
And they got an emergency call. It was when there was a. Let's see. I think it was a ship spilling oil. Hit the Oregon coast.
Oh, no.
And the governor needed her airplane or his airplane back.
You guys can't use that for sheep right now. I kind of got an emergency.
Right. So anyway, away they went. So we had to do have a new plan.
Wow.
And we did. We just did it by truck. Somebody got in the truck and hauled the blood to a lab in southern Alberta, got the results, and met us at the border.
Okay.
So... I had some friends that worked in southern BC at Cranbrook, and so we stopped there with the sheep and waited. And we didn't have to wait long.
Yeah.
But you know, always getting across the border was, and it wasn't never the Canadians, they were great.
Yeah.
It was always ours.
Classic.
It was always ours. And you'd get somebody that just wanted everything just right. And so I had one old guy. That was the head, and he was at, it's one on the Idaho border, and he was a hat collector.
Oh.
And so he says, well, I went in and told him what we were doing before. Mm-hmm. I've always tried to do that before. And we had no trouble ever there. As long as he was there, we went right through with lots of hats.
Good. You had
sounds
the hookup.
Like a little bit like bribing.
Well, it was absolutely. And he'd give us some. I should have saved some of those because they were Border Patrol hats. Because he was a Border Patrol.
Yeah, you should have saved some of
them. Yeah.
Could have been passing them out.
He did. I had a half a day. I could have had any number I wanted. But he was great. But then we had some that weren't.
Ah.
So never any in that station, but or that crossing. But
yeah,
the crossings were always, because you just can't have any delays. I mean, it's hard enough anyway. You're taking them so far, and then you know, a lot of them we took up Hell's Canyon by jet boat. So there are different transplant sites. We did some on the Minum, and they went in an old Huey helicopter from Vietnam.
Holy cow.
I had a friend that was using one to spray with, Jim Pope Jr. And so I said, well, what do you think about us?
Can we use that on Wednesday? We've got some things to do.
Yeah, and so he was there and picked us up. And we loaded him in, got in with him in the back of that thing, and two of us, and had them all trussed and the blindfolded.
Yeah.
But then it'd start getting warm from all those bodies, and we flew from that flat right there, right at the county line on the Minum.
Mm-hmm.
There's the flat there, people camp and stuff there sometimes. But anyway, we flew out of that. I've got pictures, and they're in here of loading them in that. But anyway, they started getting warm, so I cracked the doors, which, you know, you go out, you're dead.
There's no coming back from that.
No, and so anyway, I was sure glad when we got that one done, because we could haul, I think we could haul four at a time, and we had 16.
Whew.
So,
yeah, that's a couple down and backs.
That was a high adventure.
Absolutely.
But we had lots of different adventures. I always wondered what would happen if we got into a blizzard coming back, and we did one time. there was like 200 cars or off and trucks at Calgary. And it was really, we finally had to stop. It was just...
Well, you guys had the sheep with you.
We had the sheep, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Caught in a blizzard with some sheep.
Yeah.
Tough.
And as soon as it got dark, and it was just too dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So what'd you guys do?
I found this motel in, let's see, it was called the Bluebird Motel in a little town in Alberta. And she let me pull the truck and trailer right up to the door where I could see it from the room through the window.
Okay.
Because you never knew when somebody might try to mess with them.
Mm-hmm. So you stayed in the motel and the sheep were just hanging out in the trailer?
And we were out of there first thing in the morning and got to the border and on to home. We did, let's see, we lost a few sheep too.
Yeah.
They get captured myopathy from all the stress. And but not many.
Hmm.
So, but they were always exciting.
Yeah.
Those you never knew what was going to happen. And you needed a lot of people because we did them there with drop nets. And so you had to have about two people per sheep.
Mm.
And I remember that last one. We had a vet that was just super conscientious but slow.
Oh.
And it just had to weigh everyone. And, oh, it just took forever.
Oh.
And we knew we had to run the gauntlet.
Yeah, yeah. This needs to be a high-speed chase here.
Yeah, yeah. No, you could fool around going up. And I usually... had a field trip or something, a day field trip.
As you should.
But boy, when you came back, you needed to get here just as quick as you could and get them on the out.
Yeah, this is a business trip.
Yeah.
Dang.
No.
Every day for you is an adventure as a biologist around here.
I had a lot of adventures, yeah.
Dang.
Yeah, jet boat adventures and airplane adventures. I was one of the lucky ones that survived the airplanes.
Yeah.
I had a lot of friends that didn't, so.
Oh, gosh.
So.
Dang.
Over the years.
Okay, so with all those adventures, what was, like you talk a little bit about, you know, your time in Canada and those favorite moments, but what was either a favorite memory or a favorite trip or a favorite
one
aspect?
One of them that was... we went to Montana and got sheep from the Missouri Breaks and took them to Hell's Canyon, and that was quite... those Missouri Breaks are steep, but they're clay, and so those sheep had long feet.
Mm-hmm.
So the boys said, well, we're going to trim those feet? And I said, no, they're going to Hell's Canyon. We'll do it the Indian way. And just turn them out. That's what they do with horses.
Yeah.
wear them down. Mm. But a lot of times we had Nez Perce tribal wildlife people were with us on lots of those. So, anyway, we got them here and got them turned loose in Hell's Canyon. So those went to the Idaho side.
Mm.
However, I'd done a lot of reading, and I knew they swam the Missouri River, so they soon came to Oregon. So, anyway. Let's see. We went to Spence's Bridge, B.C., got some, too. And it was so unpopular with B.C. that we got shut down after, the truckers would go by. It was right on the highway.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't want us taken. British Columbia sheep to Oregon.
Huh.
So, but we ended up getting out of there with 40 or so anyway. Now let's see. A lot of the horse adventures were law enforcement in the fall too, when we'd go on horse patrols in the early days. Law enforcement patrols in the backcountry.
Oh, wow.
So.
I bet you met some characters back there.
Oh, yes, we did. And we had some adventures there, too.
I can only imagine.
With guns out and everything else.
The Wild West.
It was.
Holy cow.
It was literally the Wild West.
Dang.
So. But you just ran into all kinds. And in those days, see, there were no controls on numbers of hunters. Chesnem would have, we had check stations out there one time, and it had 4,000 hunters we checked to the check station.
4,000?
And they were there at one time. And the Winnaha had seven.
What years was
it? It was in the 70s. Wow. That was the start of the road closures.
Holy.
And then we went to limited entry, and that was an adventure too, because there are a lot of people who were used to hunting every year.
Yeah. So. Yeah, they probably weren't too happy with that.
No likes change. They weren't.
Yeah, especially.
Although most of them supported it then later, some that were really opposed because they realized you just couldn't keep going.
Right. That's not sustainable.
They would shoot literally every bull. When I do the surveys and in the spring, there'd be, I'd maybe see 3,000 elk, and there'd be maybe 14 bulls or so.
Jeez. Left.
12 to 14. And then the real heyday that we really did well with bulls and good numbers was 2000 to about 2010 or 12.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just incredible bull hunting then.
That's cool.
I got a friend that was in the Marines, and he said, "Why did I have to be in the Marines during the heyday?" No, let's see. I did a lot with game birds, too. We had some major blue grouse study we did, and I had a PhD student, Eric Pellerin, that worked on it, a lot of other summer people, and trapped and radioed birds out in Joseph Canyon.
That's cool.
So, and then we did a lot of work with sharptails, trying to restore Columbian sharptails to Oregon. And we had a population started, and I still think there's probably a few birds out here, but nobody, we've had a little problem keeping bios here in recent years. So they just haven't done anything with them really.
Mm-hmm.
So,
did you have a lot of students work with you, like, throughout your time?
Well, yeah, quite a few over the years. You'd have young ones come and
that would be pretty cool.
And then lots of, you know, we had quite a few bird studies, especially mountain quail.
Mm-hmm.
We did restoration work with them, and there was one student got his PhD on them, and Eric got his PhD on blue grouse.
Wow.
And that was always fun working with them. So we, did some stuff with spruce grouse. You know, do you know what they are?
Mm-mm.
They're,
no.
And Oregon has the blue grouse, are now called dusky or sooty grouse. They broke them into two different kinds. And then we have spruce grouse and ruffed grouse. And of course, we had Columbian sharptails over 2/3 of the state, but they were totally extirpated.
Gotcha.
And anyway, we had some grants that'd be like in the $5,000 range to get people that we knew to study them. We had
mm-hmm.
one of the local biology teachers, and he had the students, and they went out and noosed some spruce grouse in the wilderness and put radios on them, and it was really a good project, because we learned a lot about spruce grouse too. But they're only found in Wallowas in Oregon.
Wow.
So
that's pretty niche.
So endemic. So they're super endemic.
Yeah, yeah, but just very limited range.
Yeah.
And isolated.
Yeah.
Because they're not connected to canyons or, you know, bunch grass. They won't go down in those places. So they're just isolated. In fact, there was some at Hat Point, and then those fires, I think, took out the habitat and them with it. So
classic.
So
dang, you've done it all.
Yeah, let's see. We did a lot with other game birds too. Tried red-legged partridge and which is like a chucker, but they're kind of a more gentle ground chucker, but they didn't make it here or anywhere.
A gentle ground chucker.
Yeah. Not in the canyons.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not gentle ground where truckers live.
We did brood counts, bird counts for about 2-3 weeks every August. Hmm. So we'd get out on them early in the morning. And Northeast Oregon's well blessed with a lot of species.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that was always fun. And time consuming too, because
absolutely,
you had to be out on the ground.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, you got to go see the land you're working with and all the animals and everything. So with that, we're sitting in your office. There's lots of taxidermy on the walls. Tell us about, being a hunter as a biologist, that has to be.
Well, you didn't ever get to hunt on the openings.
Yeah.
In the deer and elk seasons.
Yeah.
So.
Because you were working. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm.
No, it's not that way so much, but we were all deputized, see, and so we did law enforcement too.
Gotcha.
So, but I think it was a really good system because it got you right out there with the hunters and you looked at the kills and.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You helped enforce the laws and the hunters really, for the most part, really liked having the bios out there.
Yeah.
So, and I always had really good information, like on the elk herds, and so I'd have some of that printed up and give it to them for the new counts, and they'd go over those like fine tooth comb. But
yeah, you were the gatekeeper. You have all the answers to the test.
Right, and we did. I'd go out with the on the sheep hunts too.
That's cool.
And I checked a lot of them in out there, checked the ram, and pinned them on my tailgate of my pickup.
Oh, that's awesome.
So a lot of things they don't do nowadays much
because
they're so tied up with other things. So, or nobody there.
Fair.
Which is worse.
Yeah.
But.
Dang. But yeah, you got to be with people on some of their best days probably in their life. At least a sheep or a big bull.
Awesome. I did. I was right there when I watched some of them shoot them.
That's cool.
To make sure who was shooting.
Right. Let's do some verification, boys, and then we can go ahead and throw some lead.
Yeah.
Dang, that's awesome.
So where have you traveled to hunt?
I've been to Africa a couple times, which was a real experience. And
tell us about that.
It's such a different system than we have. They're kind of quasi-private.
Yeah.
And so they have high densities. Hmm. So, and a lot of them are fenced.
Gotcha.
They're high fenced.
Hmm.
But there are some that the high fence doesn't work on, like warthogs and kudus are pretty good at getting over. That's a kudu right there. They're about elk size, and that's a Jagim's buck or oryx right here. They're really nice animals. We actually have a huntable population in New Mexico.
Wow.
So I've been down there with my son-in-law when he's had tags. So they're in the White Sands Missile Base. So you have to go through an indoctrination before you go in there. Don't pick any bombs. That's an impala. There.
Wow.
And the last time I was actually there 2 years ago, and it was totally different place, but we had to drive around to different locations, you know, where they had leased land, but the densities are just incredible.
Hmm.
And of course they're paid for them. The meat they sell, I remember we took a load of meat one time, a Toyota heaped with animal carcasses, and took it right to the supermarket.
You just don't see that at Safeway these days, you know?
Yeah, no.
Dang.
So it's a real education. Whether you hunt or not, we went to some of the parks, and some of the Kruger was just outstanding. I think it's the biggest park in the world.
Wow.
And it had elephants and everything else, and huge fences around it because there were villages right and farmland right just adjacent to it.
That's wild.
And elephants, it takes a huge fence and it's got to be electric. Rhinos, there were rhinos in it. We did drive right up to rhinos.
Huh.
African lions.
I can't say I'd want to do that.
They were so used to people, you know, that's quite a tourist here. Tourist attraction.
I guess that's fair.
So I didn't worry too much about them. They've slept most of the time. But
seems like a good gig.
Yeah, it was. But then last time we went to a different part of South Africa, and there were six of us, I guess, and so we did take a lot of animals, which they love,
because
they get paid for them.
Yeah.
But they had this is a pretty big business, and they have all these PHs that actually do the hunting with you, take you out in their Land Rover type rigs, and so you just see so much while you're hunting. Shows you what abundance is.
Absolutely.
And if it wasn't for that system, they wouldn't have anything, because people eat, but just kill them and eat them.
Right.
So, but they get lots of meat, and it provides a lot of jobs too, because they have skinners and everything else. It's kind of a luxury for an American hunter.
I was going to say, in comparison to your Eastern Oregon hunts here, you're doing all the work.
Yeah, it isn't like my backpacking up for mule deer and an allowance.
No.
Or in Hell's Canyon. A
little different vibe.
Right.
But you'd still come back here and hunt. You still like the home front.
Well, I do, but you get old enough that you can't get around. It's a trouble.
Yeah, you'll let other people do that stuff for you.
Well, we hunt right mostly on our place.
Mm-hmm.
So, but my success is not as high either.
Well, you've had some pretty good success, Vic.
I have over the years, yeah. Yeah, I've got that barn has got finished part of it in the back, and it's got a lot of other stuff in it.
I bet.
So
I'm sure that not one place could hold all the things that you've gotten in a lifetime.
Yeah. No, especially deer. It used to be that mule deer were our mainstay.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's pretty much whitetails.
Yeah.
So, but they're mostly just around the valley areas, settled areas.
Mm-hmm.
There's some out like Slid Springs and the timber, but they don't go very far into the Lawas.
Yeah, different times.
Yeah, it is.
Dang. Well, you've done whatever. You've got a whole lot of different eras in your career. Do you have a favorite time? Like in your career, where it was just like, I'm doing the coolest stuff ever, and then you ended up finding another cool thing to do.
Probably the 2000 was that decade there, from 2000 to 2010, was we were doing a lot with sheep, a lot with goats, a lot with elk, and they had all those big bulls.
The trifecta.
Yeah.
Sheep, goats, and elk.
Yeah. We were kind of by the wilderness things had been pretty well settled by then, so. And a lot of that was when a lot of the sheep left. Well, they left a little early. About 2000, the last of the sheep left the Lawas. And the last allotment, we raised the money to buy the guy out.
Really?
So we had to raise $80,000.
Shoot.
But we got it.
You guys got to work.
Yeah.
All right.
We got it from the Wild Sheep Foundation. That's one other thing I've done a lot of, is go to those conventions, and I've seen those prices. See, they sell an auction tag. A lot of the states and provinces do, and that pays for management of the sheep. But I saw ours went for $480,000 this year. New Mexico's went for $1.3 million, which is the highest I ever...
For one hunt?
For one tag, yeah, for a ram.
Wow.
Get you
one
some
tag.
That's a hell of a tag. All right.
And I, of course, had to be in this. Being smart, I had to say, and a bargain it was, too.
A bargain. No bargain shopper here.
Well, uh-huh. You ask those guys, well, and they said, well, what would you rather do, pay taxes or go on a hunt?
Well, I don't know.
Not pay taxes when you can have a hunt. It's just, I remember in the old days we used to think, we did good when we got 50,000, which
yeah. I mean, that's still good. 50K is still 50K.
Yeah, and that pays for all the management of sheep, and there's a goat tag too, oh. and pays for mountain goat management.
What's a million, you know?
Yeah, right. So I just said, I'd rather help the sheep than the government.
All right, hoorah. Uh-huh.
So,
I mean, if you got it.
Yeah, why not spend it?
Well, right, or you're going to lose it.
Totally.
So.
Yeah, spend it on something good, something cool. You'll come out with a cool adventure.
We'd always think, well, boy, there's only so many people interested in sheep, and we're going to run out of them, but it hasn't. There's so many people now that, but it's pretty exciting to watch those. They called me. I wasn't down there. They called me when our tag sold, so I heard it go to 480.
That's awesome.
But they've done a lot with bighorns in Oregon. And we work with Idaho and Washington a lot. Mm-hmm. And now Nevada, too. For Southeast, we got a group there in Idaho, Oregon, and Nevada. So
yeah, you got to have a group effort to keep it going.
Oh, it is. And the excitement kind of breeds on itself, too, with that many people and the groups. Wild Sheep Foundation chapters and
to have a mentor like yourself, and I'm sure other biologists of your era, it's like you guys have seen this from the ground up, so well,
yeah,
it's only gonna keep going.
We have and then all of the disease research has just been incredible how much we understand now.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I go through by decade in here. some just kind of a summary of what we knew and thought we knew.
Yeah.
And
thought it was a lot, but ended up being not that much.
Yeah, then we had a friend of mine, actually went on the snake with us a lot and helped us with the sheep. He was a veterinarian, and he had property over out of Seattle that he ended up selling, and then he died, and he left it to the university, WSU, for an endowed chair to work on bighorn diseases.
Wow.
So that's been a big help, yeah. Too. So a tremendous volunteers. So
yeah, leaving a legacy.
Yeah.
Dang. So with that, what's your advice to the next biologist or to the next?
Well, one thing is try to get somebody that fits the country.
Yeah.
So they're it's a difficult enough job and controversial enough, and you're better off to not say too much. You know, be a good listener.
Yeah.
Try to spend more time. That thing I would tell them is try to spend more time out with the hunters and landowners, and because that pays dividends, and that's the one weak point. And then just try to spend more time out in the field. You can turn those computers off.
Yep.
And get out there where you can really learn something. So, and it's hard for them because they're expected to work a 40-hour week, which we never did. We paid no attention. We would have been totally offended if somebody tried to tell us to do that.
Right.
But we wouldn't have done it.
Hey, you just wouldn't have listened.
And they wouldn't have known it.
Yeah.
But the other thing is get involved with the different sportsmen's groups too. So, because we're still funded, Oregon, as I say we're, I say the Oregon Department, most departments are still mostly funded by hunting license dollars and tag fees. Mm-hmm. So.
Get outside.
Get out in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
So, and most of them would enjoy it too if they got out, but then a lot of it's not their fault. They get pulled this way and that way, and they end up. Then you try to work in one of the fish and game offices with people coming in all the time. It's hard. So, but.
Right on. Simple enough.
Yeah.
Know what you're working with. Know the landscape.
Yeah.
Know your people.
Know the people.
Mm-hmm.
That's the big problem now with the wolves, and we got lots of more retiring all the time as they get older, and you can get new ones in.
Yeah.
So that would be my advice.
I like it.
Well, thank you so much for sitting down with us.
Yeah, this has been awesome.
You're sure welcome.
Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed the show as much as we did.
Like, share, subscribe, follow us, give us a review. Everything helps. And don't forget, if you need a skull cleaning, contact Lily Barnes Skull Cleaning. All the information is in the show notes on our Facebook and our Instagram. Don't forget to get outside.